Sanjeev Bhaskar reads further extracts from the latest collections of essays by Mohsin Hamid, author of The Reluctant Fundamentalist. Written in 2013, Mohsin has moved back to Lahore and looks for ways of coping with a more solitary life as an author.
For most of my life, I can't remember having thought much about whether fictional characters were likable. But when I was visiting New York recently, my editor of 15 years told me she liked to go to the website of a leading internet retailer and see what readers had to say about the books she published. One of the things readers discussed a great deal, she said, was whether characters were likable, non-likability being, in the minds of many, a serious flaw. How interesting, I thought then. How different from how I read. But I've been reconsidering the matter. And on reflection, maybe I shouldn't have been so surprised. I'll confess, I read fiction to fall in love. That's what's kept me hooked all these years. Often that love was for a character. In a pre-sexual crush way for Fern in Charlotte's Web. In a best buddies way for the heroes of Asterix and Obelix. In a sighing, I wish there were more of her in this book way for Jessica in Dune or Arwen in The Lord of the Rings. In fiction, as in my non-reading life, someone didn't necessarily have to be likable to be lovable. Was Anna Karenina likable? Maybe not. Did part of me fall in love with her when I cracked open a second-hand hardcover of Tolstoy's novel purchased in a bookshop in Princeton, New Jersey, the day before I headed home to Pakistan for a hot, slow summer? Absolutely. What about Humbert Humbert? A pedophile, a snob, a dangerous madman. The main character of Nabokov's Lolita wasn't very likable, but that voice, ah, that voice had me at fire of my loins. So I discovered I could fall in love with a voice. And I could fall in love with form, with the dramatic monologue of Camus' The Fall, or more recently, the first-person plural of Julie Otsuka's The Buddha in the Attic, or the restless, centerless perspective of Jennifer Egan's A Visit from the Goon Squad. And I'd always been able to fall in love with plot, with the story of a story. Is all this the same as saying I fall in love with writers through their writing? I don't think so, even though I do use the term that way. I'll say, I love Morrison, or I love Oates. Both are former teachers of mine, so they're writers I've met off the page. But still, what I mean is, I love their writing, or something about their writing. Perhaps, in the widespread longing for likable characters, there is this. A desire, through fiction, for contact with what we've armored ourselves against in the rest of our lives. A desire to be reminded that it's possible to open our eyes, to see, to recognize our solitude, and at the same time, to not be entirely alone. When I moved back to Lahore a few years ago, I learned what solitude was again. I left my writer friends behind. I had cousins in Lahore, a couple dozen of them, and tight childhood buddies, and aunts and uncles and nephews and nieces, but no writers I was really close to. Not at first. No one I could meet for a drink to talk shop. For that, I still needed to visit my former hometowns of New York and London, which didn't happen more than a couple of times a year. I was happy to be away from the noise of publishing, the book launches, the award ceremonies, the cycle of who got reviewed how this week, but I missed the camaraderie. Novel writing is solitary work. In Lahore, it became a solitary profession too. So I started reading novelists to hang out with them. Not their novels, which of course I'd always read, but their memoirs, their essays on their writing, their interviews. I asked my neighborhood bookshop to order up Marquez on Marquez, Calvino on Calvino, the multiple volumes of the Paris Review interviews. Ah, the Paris Review interviews. Orgiastic to a writer who's been on his own a while, let me tell you. It was in volume 4 that I came across one with Haruki Murakami, a writer I'd long admired. And halfway into that interview, I found this quote, which I wound up rereading so often that I copied it out. Writing a long novel is like survival training. Physical strength is as necessary as artistic sensitivity. I liked this. Not that I thought it was true, but I liked it. Yes, Tolstoy did his share of war fighting and Hemingway was a tough guy, but I'm not sure Nabokov could bench his weight, and I had the sense Virginia Woolf couldn't either, although her biographical details were sketchy in my mind. Nonetheless, like much else that comes from Murakami, that quote only seems easily dismissed while managing somehow to stick with you. There's a fine line between "you gotta be kidding" and "genius," and Murakami walks it all the time, or runs it, as it turns out. Because I next bought his memoir come musings on writing, What I Talk About When I Talk About Running, and learned the man runs like a fiend. He runs miles a day, every day, and then sometimes he swims. He's done ultramarathons, triathlons. He doesn't just talk the talk, he splashes runs, pedals the hell out of the walk. Now, at the time I encountered the Murakami quote, I was stuck. My third novel was going nowhere. Maybe it was being a new father. Maybe it was the spate of terrorist bombings hitting Lahore. Maybe it was the heat and the cold, because although Lahore is mostly warm, the short winters can get pretty cold, and natural gas shortages plus poor insulation means you're cold, indoors, constantly. But probably it was none of those things. My first two novels took 7 years each, and I threw out draft after draft. Being stuck comes as naturally to me as running comes to Murakami. I needed to get unstuck. And nearing the age of 40, I'd already used up many of the usual tricks writers before me had employed to shake things up when they were in a rut. Travel chemically, break your heart, change continents, get married, have a child, quit your job, etc. I was desperate. So I started to walk. Every morning. First thing, as soon as I got up, which as a dad now meant 6 or 7 a.m., I walked for half an hour. Then I walked for an hour. Then I walked for 90 minutes. My wife was amused. Goodbye, Hamid. Hello, hamster. That sort of thing. As an aside, a cousin of mine in Karachi, an anti-intellectual, hard-partying, gun-carrying, off-for-the-weekend-in-his-jeep-hunting kind of guy, took up reading around this time. His wife would wake to find him with the nightlight on, engrossed in a novel. "It's weird," she told him, "but I like it." She called it his midlife crisis. Murakami's quote is about writing long novels. I write short novels, so it made sense that while he has to run to get fit enough to do what he has to do, I could manage with just walking. And the significant speed difference notwithstanding, a daily 5-mile walk turned out to be exactly what I needed. My head cleared, my energy soared, my neck pains diminished. Sometimes I texted myself ideas, sentences, entire paragraphs as I walked. Other times I just floated along, arms at my side, stewing and filtering and looking. Walking unlocked me. It's like LSD or a library. It does things to you. I finished my novel in only 2 more years, for a total of 6, walking every day, and I don't plan on stopping. If the choice is between extended periods of abject writing failure and prescription orthotics, I know which side my man Murakami and I are on. I'm now gearing up to launch into novel 4. Murakami's quote is still taped to my printer. It's been joined by a cluster of others, from senior writers I haven't met, helping out a frequently struggling younger colleague in Lahore. A lot of their books come in the form of e-books for me. The advantages of e-books are clear. E-books are immediate. Sitting at home in Pakistan, I can read an intriguing review of a book, one not yet in stores here, and with the click of a button, be reading that book in an instant. E-books are also incorporeal. While traveling, which I do frequently, I can bring along several volumes, weightless, and indeed without volume, thereby enabling me to pack only a carry-on bag. And yet, the experience of reading e-books is not always satisfactory. Yes, it is possible to vary the size of the font, newly important to me at age 42, as I begin to perceive my eye muscles weakening. Yes, e-books can be read in the dark, self-illuminated, a convenient feature when my wife is asleep and I am too lazy to leave our bed, or when electricity outages in Lahore have persisted for so long that our backup batteries are depleted. And yes, they offer more frequent indicators of progress, their click forwards arriving at a rapidity that far exceeds that of paper flipping, because pixelated screens tend to hold less data than printed pages, and furthermore, advance singly, not in two-sided pairs. Nonetheless, often I prefer reading to e-reading. I think my reasons are related to the fact that I have disabled the browser on my mobile phone. I haven't deleted it, but I have to enter a code to expose and enable it. I can use the browser when I find it necessary to browse, but for the most part, this setting serves as a reminder to question manufactured desires, to resist unless I have good cause. Similarly, I've switched my email account from the attention and battery-consuming push setting to the less frenzied manual one. Emails are fetched when I want them to be, which is not all that often. And the browser on my slender fruit knife of a laptop now contains a readout that reminds, or as it warns me, how much time I've spent online. Time is our most precious currency. So it's significant that we are being encouraged, wherever possible, to think of our attention not as expenditure, but as consumption. This blurring of labor and entertainment forms the basis, for example, of the financial alchemy that conjures deca-billion-dollar valuations for social networking companies. I crave technology, connectivity, but I crave solitude too. As we enter the cyborg era, as we begin the physical shift to human-machine hybrid, there will be those who embrace this epochal change, happily swapping cranial space for built-in processors. There will be others who reject the new ways entirely, perhaps even waging holy war against them with little chance of success in the face of drones that operate autonomously while unconcerned shareholding populations boast selfies and status updates. And there will be people like me, with our powered exoskeletons left often in the closet, able to leap over buildings when the mood strikes us, but also prone to wandering naked and feeling the sand of a beach between our puny toes. In a world of intrusive technology, we must engage in a kind of struggle if we wish to sustain moments of solitude. E-reading opens the door to distraction. It invites connectivity and clicking and purchasing. The closed network of a printed book, on the other hand, seems to offer greater serenity. It harks back to a pre-jacked-in age. Cloth, paper, ink. For these, read helmet, cuirass, shield. They afford a degree of protection and make possible a less intermediated, less fractured experience. They guard our aloneness. That is why I love them, and why I still read printed books.
Sanjeev Bhaskar was reading from Discontent and Its Civilizations by Mohsin Hamid. The book was abridged by Eileen Horn and produced by Clive Brill. It's a Brill production for BBC Radio 4. Professor Angela Davis was known as a radical activist and member of the Black Panthers in the 1960s and 70s. 40 years on, she talks to Jenny Murray on Woman's Hour after the news about the journey from a place on the FBI's 10 Most Wanted list to a place in the 100 Cool Americans exhibition earlier this year in Washington's National Portrait Gallery. Also on the programme, a former Vogue editor and a Scottish-Zambian singer-songwriter.
My castaway this week is the actor Damian Lewis. Before Hollywood beckoned, he once enjoyed a brief career as a busker.
I was living out some sort of Easy Rider fantasy, but I did buy myself a big chopper of a motorbike, and I would stick my guitar and my tent on the back of it. I found a place in Aix-en-Provence where I was able to terrorise 5 restaurants at once. If they didn't throw coins in my hat, people would send waiters out with beer, which was a terrible mistake, because then I would never shut up, and I would still be there 2 hours later, just strumming away.
My castaway, Damian Lewis. I do hope you can join us to hear his Desert Island Discs this Friday morning at 9.